If you're here new for Sun Devil Sunday, welcome anyway. So as you recall, we've been going through Genesis. We've talked about story. We talked about creation, creation of the world, creation of man and woman. And we are moving on today to the fall and Cain and Abel and two genealogies that we don't usually read that often. So looking, I've talked a lot about source criticism and form criticism and how they've applied in a couple of places. So I just wanted to keep with that theme briefly. Chapters 2 and 3 go together. The language is the same. Most people think thematically they're the same. So usually chapter 2, the creation of man and woman, dust and breath, go with the fall. The language used with specifically for God is Yahweh Elohim is the term that kind of clinches it for people. And it finishes the story that was kind of started in 2:4. Academic critics have surprisingly little to say about chapter 3, though. Most of their attention is on chapter 2. They draw the parallels with Mesopotamian literature and such, and they don't really have much to say here. There is no equivalent to the fall story in other Mesopotamian literature. This is kind of unique. Gilgamesh, that we talked about last week, has a couple of parallels, but nothing specific. For instance, a woman causes Enkidu to become estranged from nature. Once rejected by nature, Enkidu is given clothing. Enkidu is told he will be like a god by leaving nature, and it presupposes a tree with a snake in it at one point. Those are kind of the four things in Gilgamesh that are kind of similar to this Genesis 3 story. An example of where they go with interpretation of this, because of the lack of outside material, is that all of this serpent episode should be interpreted as a pushback against ancient Mesopotamian sexual sin. They point to knowing in the biblical sense that snakes can be interpreted as phallic symbols, and that's where they go with it. But that's not where we're going with it, because we're going to look at how man falls out of relationship with God, and how man falls out of relationship with woman, and how he falls out of relationship with the earth, and how he falls out of relationship with his brother. That's what it's about, not about the other thing. So let's talk about what we have here in chapter 3. Oh, Genesis chapter 3. Yeah. So we have the fall, right? I'm one page ahead. The passage is vital because it explains the world as we see it today. It depicts the entrance of sin into the human race and the severity of the consequences for the disobedience of that human race. There's also the revelation of grace, seeking out the sinner and providing covering for sin, promises of a savior. It gives a basis historically for other passages regarding women and leadership roles in the church, and we'll talk about that a little bit more later. It informs us about the way Satan may work. It challenges us to consider whether or not we continue to fall today. So, mechanically speaking, what do we see in the text? We start with the serpent, right? What do we know about the serpent? He's crafty. In Hebrew, crafty is a neutral word. It can be either commendable or reprehensible. It's used both ways. There's a question of whether the snake is one of God's creatures. It's not set up and says God created this snake, but it certainly doesn't depict the serpent as co-equal with God. It's powerless to stop God's punishment, and it doesn't abide by the rest of creation. Abide by the rule set up by God. We know that the serpent speaks. It does not mention the tree of life at all. He does not himself mention the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The way that he approaches the entire question is, he says, did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden? He kind of is asking for correction, so he's not coming out and saying, God didn't say any of this. He's kind of going, well, tell me if I'm wrong here, but did God really say that? He couldn't have really meant that. So we have an initial way that he moves before he then moves over to telling blatant lies. So the big question that we always have, because no one ever can satisfactorily say yes or no, it seems like, is the serpent indeed Satan? What do you guys think? is the serpent Satan in Genesis 3. How so? He said he represents it. How so? That's true. He does counterman God. He does. He does use his own will rather than God's will. Yeah. Right. Right. He said that using other characteristics that we see of Satan, that he accuses and deceives rather than and so that's consistent, right? Is that saying it right? Right, right. Well, let me give you a couple of scriptures to think about and some things to think about here. In Ezekiel, I'm going to start on the yes side of things because it's a little more thoroughly thought out, I think.
Yeah, so like, yes, the serpent is Satan. Yeah.
So if we're to say, yes, the Satan and serpent are the same thing. You have Ezekiel 28, 13 or 19. This is called the oracle or promise against the king of Tyre or Tyre, however you want to say it, where we're having the imagery of an angel thrown out of heaven. And this is where the first place where that idea comes from, that Satan may be a fallen angel. It's specifically an oracle against a king, so you have to take it with a grain of salt, but it does describe something that is certainly sounds like potentially Satan is a fallen angel. In Revelation 12 and in Revelation 20, you have Satan referred to as the dragon and the serpent of old. So those are images consistent with a snake or a serpent. You have John 3:14, where Jesus compares himself to the bronze snake statue. And think of the imagery here. If Moses lifted up this bronze snake statue in the wilderness to drive snakes away from the Israelite camp. Do you guys remember this episode? You've heard this story before? So imagine this imagery where Jesus says, I'm here to drive the serpent away from mankind by being lifted up on the cross. It adds a layer of imagery to that analogy if we think that Satan is in fact the serpent. It makes that even a more vivid picture, if you will. That was John 3:14. We're just looking real quickly. Yeah, we're talking about Genesis 3, but we're looking at some other scriptures to help interpret one little bit of whether the serpent and Satan are the same thing or not. So, yeah, and that's a perfectly valid thing, and there are people who say no, and so I just wanted to present both of them. So, one more scripture on the side of yes. You have Luke 10:18, where Jesus says, I saw Satan thrown out of heaven or fall out of heaven. So those are all scriptures in favor of potentially, yes, Jesus is in fact, not Jesus, Satan is in fact the serpent here in Genesis 3. On the no side, here in Genesis, you don't have Satan mentioned at all. This is just a serpent that starts talking for whatever reason. And then you also have in Matthew, you have Jesus commanding his disciples that he's sending out to be shrewd or wise or crafty as snakes or serpents. I don't know that Jesus would use that imagery if being a serpent was specifically connected to being Satan. So it's just a thought that he commands his disciples to be crafty, just like the serpent here in Genesis 3 is crafty. Mitchell, you have your hand up. Yeah, I actually wasn't getting into that because I have my own thoughts about Satan in general that I thought I would leave out of this, but that's one of the things that I point to personally. Peter says, Does Peter say that as well? I know Jesus does. He says that in Matthew, but I don't know if Peter does offhand.
I think that's interesting, because I think we'll see that with his conversation with Eve.
I was going to say, Michael, and then we're coming to, because this was a perfect segue into the tactics section, so. It is possible. I'm not going to discount that this could be a test from God, because one of the arguments of creation, in terms of strict world was created in 4004 BC, is that dinosaurs or fossils are actually tests from God built into the world, because there's no other way to explain them there. Interesting thought. But I want to come back to this segue about how Satan uses a half-truth or a twist of the truth, because I wanted to talk specifically about what the serpent says here and look at how he does it. You notice he comes in and says, does God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden? He doesn't challenge Eve's faith. He's not coming as an atheist. He's not coming as a counter to what she knows. It's just starting a conversation with a simple slant on it. Did God really say that? There's lots of innuendo really happening. We can imply, though, from what Eve responds, that there is potentially a problem between what God said and what Eve knows. So God's command to Adam was, do not eat of the tree or you will die. And for one reason or another, either because Adam said it differently or because Eve understood it differently, Eve says, you must not eat from the tree that is in the middle of the garden, and you must not touch it, or you will die. So did Adam give a different command? Is Eve defending God's position? There's something different potentially between what God said and what Eve said as recorded.
I think this is very interesting. And are we going to talk about culpability in a little bit?
Yeah, we're going to talk about that later.
All right. This theory has very interesting implications on whose fault the fall is. So stay tuned. Buckle up.
But it seems like the serpent's goal here is not to cause disobedience, per se, but to cause doubt, right, from the initial stage of this conversation. It distorts rather than refutes God. It distorts what God has said rather than refuting God. And then it continues, and it says, you will not surely die, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. So he kind of implies that creation is incomplete. He says your eyes will be opened, that there's something wrong with you as you are now, Eve, and if you eat this tree, that'll be fixed. Eat the fruit from this tree, that will be fixed. He promises, of course, that Eve will be like God. Now, we talked last week a little bit about merisms, where you use two opposites to mean the entirety of the whole. And so I just want to raise here that you know, he said, we've now raised the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So are we looking at the tree of the knowledge of everything? Is that a potential here? Just something to think about. It's not really answerable. It's just something that literary critics like to raise specifically. But God, what the serpent does promise is a new knowledge. And I just wanted to, I saw the one commentary that said this promise of new knowledge is something that continues to be a theme throughout the Bible. In Proverbs 9, you have a character described as the woman of folly, and she entices others by offering a new experience. Here's something new that you didn't have before. And it's the same tact. The woman of folly does the same thing then that Satan is doing in offering this. Here's something new to you that you don't have already, and you're going to want that. Do you have something to say about that?
Okay, keep
going. Okay. There's another thing that was presented to us that we now have Eve and Adam eating of the fruit, and that potentially it's not this new knowledge that's the problem, but this one commentator suggested that gluttony is, in fact, the first sin, this eating of fruit that they didn't need. You didn't need this food, and you ate it anyway, so potentially gluttony is the first sin. Anyway, the serpent then, he says, you will not surely die. So now he gets to a lie. He's already hooked with a half thought with an implication, and now that he's got curiosity going, he kind of hooks it in with a lie and says, you won't die. That's not part of the problem. He suggests basically that Eve shift her commitment from God's will, doing what God has said, to doing what appeals to her own will.
And this is what I think is interesting, is like, what is the motive behind this decision? Because, you know, of course we have this like possible communication disruption, but then also like, because I think that when you spend, I imagine when you spend every day with God, walking in the garden, being friends, I can understand the desire to be like God. So was this a situation of Eve truly like rebelliously going against her commitment to God, or was this more of a situation of her having good intentions and wanting to be more like God? So I always think that we just throw Eve under the bus. So what about you? What do you think, Mitchell?
What I think is interesting is the law that is made is assuming they weren't already like God. Mm-hmm. As we read last week, we were made in God's image. We weren't made like God. And so there's that deception that the, you know, the serpent presents, which is, oh, well, he doesn't want you to have it because he knows you'll be like God.
Like that point.
All right. Well, let's ask two small things. The serpent here, all of the language about God is using the term Yahweh Elohim, but then the serpent refers to God just as Elohim, and so people have asked, is this a sign of a rebellious attitude toward God? And it's a little linguistic hook potentially for that. And then we have the question of, should Eve have been talking to the serpent? That's been raised in several contexts. Jenna was listening to a podcast that raised that question, and I've read some commentators that raise the same thing, that there's an order within the creation that we see. We have God, and then we have Adam, and then we have Eve, and then we have the rest of creation. And then the fall then occurs in the reverse order, because the serpent talks to the woman, who then talks to the man, who then talks to God. So is this, I guess the question is that reversal potentially part of the cause of the fall? I don't think I can answer that. It's just something that's been raised. Moving on from the serpent, we then have Eve. She's not actually named Eve until after this entire episode. We're told in 3:6 that Adam is with her. So we can probably... We can probably assume that Adam heard everything that was said to Eve, if he is actually with her. So the question has to be raised, does Adam assent to her conduct by silence, by not saying anything? Does he share some of the culpability here for her eating in the first place? But what if Adam is not there then? Because we have he's with her, but we don't know that he actually heard anything. If Adam was not there, you think that when Eve comes to him, he probably says, I want to know about the good and the bad of what you've just done. Obviously, you aren't dead yet, Eve, so maybe what we've been told isn't true. Is that evidence enough for him to go ahead and eat the fruit, too? I think I would probably do the same thing if Hannah came to me and said, "Hey, here, have this fruit. I'm not dead yet." Go, "Oh, all right." But there's nothing more said about Adam except that he eats it. And then we already talked a bit about this new knowledge, and if that's just too enticing of a carrot for Eve to resist. But it raises the question, why would you take the word of the creation over that of the Creator? What drives us to do that? Again, it's not really a question we can answer, especially in a short time, but that's a serious question here that, you've seen the serpent, and why do you believe that over the God that's talked to you and walked with you? I also wanted to briefly introduce this rabbinic take it's a more modern rabbinic take. We already talked about how the word was given to Adam, and then Adam potentially gave it to Eve a little bit differently. There's a Jewish teaching that, upon saying that we're not supposed to touch it either, that the snake grabbed her and grabbed the woman and forced her to touch the tree, and that's how she found out that she wouldn't die. And then it's from her own reason, well, if I can touch the tree and not die, then I can eat from the tree and not die. And so the Jewish rabbis ask the question, is God responsible himself for this by not talking directly to the woman about the consequences? They also ask, if God is omniscient and all-powerful, did God plan the fall? Or did God merely know that the fall would happen and not do anything about it? So they ask if he's culpable for failing to prevent the fall. They also ask, why did he place the garden, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, in the garden? And those are all, I think, fair questions that we have to take. But the modern rabbinic tradition is that God, man, and woman are all responsible for the fall.
We saw this really interesting article of a rabbi who thought that from a very extreme feminist perspective, that if God had just talked to Eve, like, none of this would have happened. So yeah. I thought that was really interesting.
It does. But they're saying everything would have been clearly communicated then, and it wouldn't have just been because of miscommunication between man and woman, or between God and woman, or somewhere in that. She did know what she was supposed to do.
Well, okay, so as we're talking about this, I really question that, though, because if they've lived in perfect harmony and unity with each other and with God and with creation, I don't know, like, were they equipped to deal with this scenario? I mean, if, like, for example, Adam would have never, until this point, had a reason to question Eve. He would have never had any reason to doubt her. And then Eve, I don't know, maybe an episode like this had occurred before, but maybe an episode like had never occurred like this. Like, why would she have any reason to doubt creation? We know that we have to have all of our allegiance to God because we know that there are forces in the world that are asking for our allegiance. So I just don't know if they're equipped to deal with this scenario. So maybe Jay and I are ripping this thing to shreds a little bit too much, maybe.
Well, we're just examining different lenses because these are different ways it's been presented, and we just want to get the discussion going about how this can be understood and what that means to us. So we're not discounting anything. We're including things that we don't necessarily agree with, but that are presented in coherent terms. I wouldn't disagree with you at all. I would just say maybe that rabbi guy does, and that's why it has to be presented. That's all. So, yeah, I mean, what we're talking about is why the world is the way it is today, right? I mean, why there is sin in the world. Where did it come from? And, of course, man's rebellion against God is where it starts. That's what we're reading. And so then people like to explore how that came about, you know. So, yeah.
I do think that we need to really, like, kind of pull the individual components of the story apart, too, because even this podcast that Jay mentioned, I listened to, discussed how, this wasn't the point of the podcast, but it was just a side note, that this interaction with Eve being the one to, like, you know, eat the apple or the fig or whatever kind of fruit it was first, has kind of led to our modern society's, like, general criminalization of women and not typically allowing them to be in leadership roles or thinking that they cannot be in leadership roles and perform as efficiently as men can. So I do think that it's very important that we examine, like, the individual components here.
Well, then let's move on, yeah, real quickly through the consequences and the punishment then of this sin, and then we'll move over to Cain and Abel. So their eyes are opened. They see they are naked. Presumably then they're ashamed because they then make coverings for themselves. There's a loss of innocence here. People are ashamed of being face to face with each other. Even though there's no one else to see, they're still ashamed of being face to face. People raise the question, of course, of was there sex before the fall? There are no children mentioned, is all I'm going to say. The children are only mentioned after they're cast out of Eden. And then we see them hiding from God. They're doing their best to, you know, when you get that guilty feeling, you want to avoid the situation, or you kind of dread facing the people. You ditch a phone call or don't respond to a text message, or, you know, you just try to avoid the confrontation. And I think that's what we see here. Or you lie about it. And then when you have God then walking through the garden and he says, Adam, where are you? You have Adam responding with, it wasn't me, God, it was you and it was the woman, and we're gonna blame everyone else but me. And then the woman says, well, yeah, I did that, but the snake, you know, he was over there talking to me. And so she places blame as well. But she doesn't blame Adam, funny enough, even though Adam potentially was with her. So I thought that was interesting, too. Moving over to the punishments, you have the first thing, I think, Travis. Right.
Because this is the first sin. And so dealing with the consequences of a bad decision, this is all brand new to them.
That's right.
So I would argue that God did equip them for stuff, you know, because he doesn't want them to fail, and so he's probably given them, make sure that he's got what they have, what they need to be successful and not succeed. But he hasn't equipped them for sin and how you get away with things and how you react and not appear like you did something wrong.
That's right. So I want to talk about the punishment. The first punishment, or maybe this is still even a consequence, is you have the separation from God. You have the beginning of the spiritual death. You don't have immediate death. You don't have the, on that day you will die, not death specifically on that day, but this starts the process that fulfills that promise of death. It's the same alienation we have today still, though. Viewed in one light, I guess in a more Christological light, that's not as big a problem anymore. But just in general, there's still this separation between man and God. Punishment then is also given to the serpent and the woman and the man. Each one is different. There's a curse and a promise on to the serpent. The curse is to crawl on their belly and they'll eat dust. But it's been pointed out that snakes don't eat dust, so whether or not this was an actual snake is brought into debate, apparently, by this one line.
Just personal note, I don't think it was a snake. I think it was a dude walking around, and Eve was like, I'm going to talk to this guy. Don't think it was already a snake. So,
yeah. But the promise is, though, that the seed of the woman, the offspring of the woman, will crush the head of the snake. So if this is Satan, if we're looking at this Christologically, what we have here is Satan winning a Pyrrhic victory. He's won on the day. He's got him cast out of heaven. He even wins on the, on another day that, that that Jesus is crucified. But Jesus wins the war. He carries the entire thing. He crushes the head of Satan by that death. A note on that, too, is that even Jews back, you know, hundreds and thousands of years, believed this passage should be understood messianically, not specifically about Jesus, but about a Messiah that will, in fact, restore the relationship between God and man. You had your hand up. Part of being made in the image of God is the image is the ability to choose things, to create things as well that are not necessarily godly. So, including our own realities, if you will.
Yeah. I think that's an interesting point. It also kind of leads me to like this idea that we have no idea how long they had been living in the garden to this point. It's possible that they had been living in harmony for hundreds of years with God. And then, like, or it's possible that they had been living in harmony with for 5 days. Knowing humans, probably 5 days. You guys, Michaela, sorry, Michaela first.
Well, that's an interesting thought, too, because when we're looking at God's punishment here, and we don't see, like, there's no, God never takes pleasure in punishing, right? We talk about the wrath of God, but it's not like wrath, like vindictive wrath. It's not like, I've got to do this and I want to do this. It's here we go again. Now we have to try to fix this problem. So what are we going to do about it? And so, having this opposite viewpoint from Satan or from that I want this separation because I've suffered this and now I want it. That's an interesting thought. I've not thought of it that way before.
Weird misery loves company kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, we're running short on time, so we're going to push Cain and Abel to next week and just finish up here on the punishment. So we're going to take a little bit longer here. The punishment on the woman. Remember. We're talking about a text written to ancient peoples. And so the punishment here in Genesis speaks to the two places that a woman found value in the ancient world, her role as a mother and as a wife. And basically, it's a promise of pain and servitude in those worlds. As we mentioned before, there's no childbirth mentioned before this pronouncement. And so what you have here is in 3:16 is, I will greatly increase your pains in childbearing. With pain you will give birth to children. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. Pain in childbirth can also be translated as toil in childbirth. That would echo potentially some of the punishment given to Adam if you said, well, it's you're going to work and you're going to have childbirth now, and in fact there's going to be pain in your childbirth. So it's a slight twist on that. It kind of gets rid of, linguistic scholars like it because it gets rid of the double, you're going to have pain in childbirth. Why say that twice when you can say it once? Yeah, go ahead, Mitchell. That's true. I would also point out that we have this curse, but Jesus comes through this. It's also a promise because we see Jesus coming through this line of childbirth now. You're going to have childbirth, and in fact, your salvation is going to come from it. So it's not entirely a curse. We start seeing a provision of God's mercy there. It may be a long and painful process to get there, but it'll happen. And as for the second part, the desire will be for your husband and he will rule over you. That's traditionally been interpreted four different ways. One is sexual desire. One is psychological dependence. I guess that's two. Three is that the wife should desire what the husband desires. And the fourth one, which has been more popular recently with the advent of modern feminism, is it's a control problem. Is this a usurpation of power somehow? The question is raised then, is patriarchy the result of a fallen state? And what about the order of creation? Does that speak into it as well?
And if patriarchy is the result of a fallen state, does that mean, like in Jesus' prayer, on earth as it is in heaven, that we should be trying to move out of that kind of patriarchal state?
Yeah. Certainly we do have a statement about gender relations, and it's interesting here because it's divorced from the context of the immorality of the Corinth church. We have to ask the question, is it prescriptive? Is this the way it should be, or is it descriptive? This is the way it will be because that's what's going to happen. These are, you know, all questions that can't be answered easily. They're just things to think about as you're going through it. There was one more thing that we found last night that I forgot to include in here. The desire simply means desire. We're talking about idolatry here. Your desires should be for God. But instead, it's going to be for your husband. Is that replacing, you know, what you should be worshiping with another? That's another way to think about it that actually really resonated with me. I thought that was a great explanation. And then let's talk about the punishment on the man. The same way that the woman was tagged in the areas where she was valuable in the ancient world, the man is tagged the same way. He was supposed to work the land, and now that's going to be hard. It wasn't hard before, but now it's going to be difficult. You're going to return to dust. You know, it's the same kind of vein that we're targeting where you feel like you're important, and those are the things that are going to change. It looks like Adam accepts his punishment. He names the woman Eve, which means living or life, that she's going to be the mother of all living people.
I also think it's very ironic that only after we've had spiritual death is Eve named life. So just food for thought.
And so some questions that are raised about the punishment, which is kind of where we're ending, are, do Adam and Eve share equal responsibility for the fall? Are they punished evenly? Should they be punished evenly? Those are some questions that we'd like to raise that for you guys to think about going through that. And just one last thing, and then we really have to stop. We're talking about mercy and grace in the fall story, because that's where we really think this is interesting. And we have to ask, is the punishment the wrath of God, the revenge of God, or is it God's way of incentivizing a return to relationship with him? Why on earth, if God, if you have an easy life and nothing changes, would you want to return to relationship with God? I say, why on earth? Because we're talking about creation. No. So that's something that I thought was really interesting, that there's no reason to return to God if nothing changes. Then the serpent would have been right. You're just as good as God, or just as good without God as you are with God at that point. And it speaks to our dependence and relationship with God and why we would want that. God provides for man even though he's punishing him. You look at the covering of the animal skins that God makes for the people before he sends them out of the garden. I'd like to point out that God's righteousness is routinely compared to clothing in the Old Testament, that it's a covering over people, the same language that we have here. It's also potentially an allusion to Jesus, if we look at it Christologically, that Jesus will then cover us and cover our sins. And then they're also thrust from the garden, which sending out is actually the proper term, rather than thrusting. It's a less forceful term. But it's a kind of a merciful act. It's a promise that this punishment, even though you have to be gone from the garden, it's not going to last forever. If I didn't provide you with this covering, if I didn't provide you with this incentive to return to me, if I didn't give you this something else, if I didn't give you death, you would never return to me. You'd just be out in the world without me forever. So it's interesting that even the death of man can be seen as an act of mercy to save from eternal punishment.
An invitation back into life.
Yeah. And with that, we've already gone over our grace period that we're supposed to end today. Thank you all for being here, and we'll pick up with Cain and Abel next week.